Ok, je vous propose de commencer le séminaire. Je suis très heureux d'accueillir aujourd'hui Laura Schulz, qui nous vient spécialement de MIT, de Boston, pour cette conférence. Donc, thank you so much, Laura. Laura is a young professor of cognitive science at MIT. She got a training in Michigan, I think, and after that in Berkeley. And she's the author of a set of publications, starting with Alison Gopnik, who is a very famous and important developmental psychologist, and then with other people, including Josh Tenenbaum. More recently, I spoke a lot about Josh Tenenbaum's work in this course this year. The approach is really to try to understand, as I see it, you will give us much more detail, but to try to model the successive inferences that are going on in the child's mind. And it's exactly, I think, it's a perfect conclusion for this seminar, because you will show the complexity of the inferences that can be drawn by even a very young child in a context of a social interaction or minimal perceptual action interaction. I have told you repeatedly in my course that we should not underestimate the architecture of the cortex of the young child and the sophistication of the computations that are going on in the child's mind. And even a very young baby in the first year of life may perhaps be considered as a hierarchical Bayesian inference system that is able to draw causal inferences at many different levels. Well, this is exactly the topic of Laura's talk today. And the title is The Origins of Inquiry. The title has changed, actually, but it's The Origins of Inquiry, Inference and Exploration in Early Childhood. And again, thank you very much for accepting my invitation.
Thank you so much for the invitation. And I'm sorry that my French is not good enough to deliver the lecture in French, but I will try to speak slowly. My research program is about learning. I'm interested in the processes that support accurate inference and effective discovery. This research program emerged against the backdrop of two major revolutions in our understanding of cognitive development. One is the infancy revolution and the recognition that preverbal babies understand much more about objects and their properties, number and quantity, and agents and their goals, intentions, and even beliefs than was previously believed. The other revolution is in our understanding of early childhood and the recognition that these kind of structured, abstract representations applied not only to knowledge that was plausibly innate in our species and in other species, but to much of how children understood the world in the first few years of life, such that 2-, 3-, and 4-year-old children had abstract, coherent, causal representations of many events in the world, representations that supported explanation, prediction, intervention, and even counterfactual claims in a way that seemed to justify referring to them as folk theories about the world. Taken together, these two revolutions dismantled Piagetian stage theory and suggested that there was never a time in cognitive development where infants were only sensory motor learners, or where children were only concrete learners. And as such, these revolutions had very important implications for learning. Taken in and of themselves, however, neither of these were primarily theories of learning. They were basically about the kind of knowledge children represented and the structure of those representations. And I think that point can be made particularly clear by looking at this popular science book that came out in 1999. It's a book about children's folk theories. And although the subtitle refers to how children learn about the world, the chapter headings are actually what children learn about people, what children learn about things. And I can say this with some authority and deep reverence, because the first author is my dissertation advisor, and the book came out in 1999, which is the year that I started graduate school. So both literally and metaphorically, this is where I began. I also began with this metaphor of the child as scientist. And it's a problematic metaphor, because science is this historically recent, culturally specific institution. It's practiced by a tiny minority of the human species. And it's difficult for learners at every level of acquisition. So it might seem a peculiar place to look for universals of human cognition. But science has this peculiar property, which is it gets the world right. It supports startlingly accurate new predictions and startlingly effective interventions. So if you're interested in learning, you might want to ask, how is this kind of knowledge acquisition possible? What is it that lets our species actually do anything of this nature? And the answer to that question is, of course, that we both do and do not know. We can formally and informally characterize many of the practices that scientists engage in. Here are a few of them. They'll all be familiar to you. They would be equally familiar to you if you were a biologist or a chemist or a paleontologist. These are the kinds of epistemic practices that characterize science independent of content domains. If you did everything on this list, you couldn't necessarily do science, because science requires bringing these kinds of inferential processes to bear on detailed, specific content knowledge. On the other hand, if you had all the detailed cultural knowledge we've acquired and you didn't engage in these inferential practices, you couldn't learn anything at all. So there's an argument that these practices are core to inquiry and discovery. And in fact, the hypothesis that governs my research program is that they're fundamental to inquiry and discovery. They emerge not just in science, but in cognitive development. And in fact, you will find the hallmarks of each and every one of these epistemic practices present in infancy and early childhood, precisely because these are the only rational inferential processes we know of that can get the world right, that could potentially address the hard problem of learning, which is precisely the problem of how to get rich, abstract, structured knowledge from sparse, noisy data. I said we could characterize these processes both formally and informally. By formally, I mean here primarily my computational modeling colleagues. But it is true that for each and every one of these individual processes, we're getting closer and closer to developing formal computational accounts of how they work. So just drawing from some of my previous studies, we can characterize formally how the prior probability of different hypotheses might interact with different patterns of covariation evidence to support children's causal judgment. We can say something about how isolating variables might formally maximize information gain. And we can say how different inferences or assumptions about sampling processes might predict different kinds of generalizations about object properties. But with all due respect to my computational modeling colleagues, and slightly, I hope not to disappoint Sten Behane, I think that although we very much would like there to be simple, elegant, unified principles of learning, things like Hebb's rule or Roscorla-Wagner, or most recently, Bayes' law, there is no computational model that we know of that can generate all and only the processes that support inquiry and discovery, which is to say there's nothing magic or exhaustive about this list. These are examples of the kinds of things we do, but we don't yet have a full computational theory of mind that says why these processes and not others. Although we can model each of the processes individually, we don't have any generative system that can model all of them. Developing this unified theory of hypothesis generation, discovery, and inquiry is, I think, a hard problem of cognitive science, and one I think all of us hope to contribute to. What we can do, however, and what I've tried to do in my research program, is provide empirical evidence that this is what we have to do, because this is the kind of learning that very young children are engaging in within the first few years of life. So this is what our theories have to aspire to, because empirically, I think this is the case. So what I'm going to do today is just focus on a few examples and show you the kinds of abilities that we can see in early childhood, and go from there. And I'm going to cover a very big range of early childhood here, just to sort of illustrate a span of abilities, starting with 15 months, going up to about 6 or 7 years. My research program's focused primarily on what I take to be universals of human cognition. So the age differences here reflect primarily task demands, although I'd be happy to talk at the end about what I think changes in cognitive development. I'm going to start today talking about generalizing evidence from samples. This is the kind of thing that's very basic to scientific inquiry, of course. We always take a small sample and we draw vast inferences about human cognition or animal cognition or about the nature of the world. And there are lots of things that support generalization, of course. You can always use feature similarity or knowledge of category membership to infer that things that look alike or belong to the same category will share properties. So for instance, if I know that this sample of Martian rocks has a high concentration of silica, I may want to infer that all Martian rocks have a high concentration of silica. Or if I know that this sample of needles from Pacific silver fir trees lies flat across the branch, I might want to infer that all Pacific silver fir needles lie flat across the branch. We know very young children can do this. If you tell them one blicket activates a toy, they assume other blickets activate the toy. If they know that one funny looking block activates the toy, they assume that other blocks that look like it will activate the toy. But as scientists, we can ask other kinds of questions. Sometimes we might know something about how evidence was sampled, and that changes the way we want to generalize our inferences. For instance, we can ask suspicious questions like these. We can say, well, do all Martian rocks have high concentrations of silica, or only those dusty rocks on the surface that were really easy to collect? Do all Pacific silver fir needles lie flat on the branch, or again, just those ones low on the canopy that were really easy to collect? And if we think that our evidence might have been cherry-picked in some way, we might constrain our inferences. We might, in this case, say, no, it only applies to those samples that are actually near the ground. It doesn't generalize quite as broadly. And in this first study, what we wanted to ask is, well, do inference generalizations also take sampling processes into account? Do they consider how evidence was generated? And to do this, we showed babies a box, and it had a transparent front. And the box had, in this case, 30 blue toys and 10 yellow toys. The toys are actually glued to the front of the box, so the visual scene remains the same for the babies across babies and throughout the trials. But as far as the babies can tell, it's a box full of toys. We reach in, and we pull out a blue ball, and we squeak it. And we reach out, pull a second blue ball, squeeze it, and it squeaks. And we pull out a third blue ball, we squeeze it, and it squeaks. And then we hand the baby a yellow ball, and the question is, what will the baby do? In this case, both the feature information and the category information would tend to support generalization. They look kind of alike. To an adult observer, these are all dog toys. So we might expect the babies to squeak it. And from our perspective, what's important here is also that this evidence, there's nothing fishy about it. It's consistent with sampling randomly from the whole box. If you can randomly sample some balls that squeak, perhaps everything in the box squeaks. So together with the feature information, we predicted in a condition like this, the infants would try to squeeze the ball. And they should squeeze often because we've actually disabled this yellow ball. It doesn't squeak, it's inert. But if they have an expectation that it should squeak, they should perseverate and squeak frequently. We can compare this condition with a condition like this, where we pull the same sample of evidence, three blue balls, but this time we pull them from a mostly yellow box. Now again, nothing's changed, of course, about the feature information or about the category, but if babies are sensitive to the relationship between the sample and the population, they should say, well, that sample is extremely unlikely to have been generated randomly from the whole box. It's much more likely to have been selectively sampled, perhaps just from the population of the box that actually has the property. If that's the case, then the babies should conclude that the yellow ball probably does not squeak. And we would predict in this condition that fewer children should try to squeeze the ball, and they should squeeze much less often. So I'll give you an example of what this looks like over here. You'll see two babies. Actually, let me back up. You're going to see two babies. They're, of course, given the same toy, and they're the same age, so you're going to see a lot of the same behaviors. But critically, only the baby on top actually ever squeezes the ball here. It actually has this attachment here precisely so the babies, if they want to do something other than squeezing, they can do so. So I'll show you what it looks like here.
Daddy, this is for you.
You can go ahead and play.
Why don't you go ahead?
That one's for you. You can go ahead and play.
What's that?
That's for you.
Mm.
So that's what we found generally. I should say for all our methods here, if you're not familiar with developmental methods, we code from videotape. The coders are not the experimenters. The coders are blind to condition. They're frequently even blind to what the conditions are and to the hypothesis, but they never know which condition the baby's in. We always ask them to code both for the measures of interest and for any factor that we or reviewers think it could be a confound or a concern. So there's going to be differences, individual differences in every baby and in every tape that I show you. But for all the data I report and that we publish, the only systematic differences are the ones that coders blind to condition have decided differentiate the conditions. So I'll show you now the results of a t-test comparing the mean number of squeezes that the babies generated in each of these conditions. We also looked at the percentage of children who squeezed, and the results are the same across both measures. So as you'll see, the babies were much more likely to generalize the property when it looked like it came from a representative sample than when it looked like it came from a selective sample here. So the babies are sensitive to something, but you might think they're sensitive to something less sophisticated than the sampling process. You might say, well, maybe babies are willing to generalize from a property of a majority object to a minority, but not the reverse. So to test that, we replicated the condition you just saw, where we pulled three blue balls from a mostly yellow box, and we compared it with a condition that looked like this, where we pulled just one blue ball from a mostly yellow box. And what's interesting about this sample is you could reach in at random to a box of mostly yellow balls and pull out one blue ball just by chance. That's not an improbable sample. It could have been generated by random sampling. So although the babies are actually going to see much less squeezing here, three blue balls here and only one here, we predicted the baby's pattern would reverse, that the babies would actually be much more likely to squeeze the ball themselves in this condition than in this condition. So critically, and they're not just going to imitate, and they're not just going to be affected by the number of balls squeezed, they're actually going to consider whether that evidence is plausibly representative or not. Now, you might be worried that we're drawing excessive attention to the blue balls here, having matched for everything else, and so that's why the babies don't generalize. So we ran this condition in two different ways, once where we pulled one blue ball and we squeezed it once, and once where we pulled one blue ball and we actually squeezed it three times. We didn't predict any difference in those conditions. And that's, of course, what we found. So what you'll see here is the babies are much more likely to squeeze the ball when just one ball is pulled from the box than they are when there's three blue balls from the box, regardless of how often you squeeze that one ball. So it does suggest that they're really paying attention not just to the evidence, not just to its features or its categories, not just to what the experimenter is doing, but to the statistical relationship between the evidence they got and the probability that they should have gotten that evidence by random sampling. I'm not going to speak about computational models in detail here, but I will say that our model predicted that inferences here should be graded with respect to the evidence, so that as the sample got progressively less likely by chance, the baby should squeeze progressively less often. And what you'll see is we saw the one ball condition, the three ball condition, these are the results of the two ball condition, and you'll see it's intermediate between the one ball and the three ball condition, and fits very well a model that is suggesting that babies jointly infer how the evidence is sampled and the extension of the object properties up there. And in this case, infer that the evidence is being selectively sampled. This relies on an inference or an assumption about the sampling process that the agent is selectively sampling the evidence. What if we specify the sampling process? What if we just tell the babies we're randomly sampling from this box? And we do that with explicit behavioral cues. We turn this box upside down, we shake it, and guess what? Three blue balls fall out. We can do this because we're at MIT and we have secret compartments in our boxes. So three blue balls fall out. This is not a representative sample. It's extremely improbable. But we've just specified a random sampling process. And if you can shake a box and generate three squeaky blue balls, probably every ball in that box squeaks. So in this case, we thought that the babies, if they're attending to the sampling process, should in fact generalize the property and should squeeze very often. And that's in fact precisely what we found. So So I could say a lot more about the model and what babies are inferring about the different sampling processes, but I'm not for right now because I think the critical empirical point is simply this. 15-month-old generalizations take into account much more than category membership or the perceptual similarity of objects. At 15 months, they're making graded inferences about the extension of object properties that are sensitive both to the amount of evidence they observe and the process by which that evidence is sampled. In this, and by the way, feel free to interrupt me with questions if I'm going too fast or if you have any. In this next study, we're confronted babies with what I take to be one of the most fundamental problems of confounded evidence that human beings face, and it's the basic problem that we're immersed in the world. And this might not seem like a problem to you, but like most problems, it's only a problem when things go wrong. If something doesn't work, you may not know where the source of error is. Is it me? Is it out there in the world? How can I tell the difference? So that's the kind of problem we're going to give to the babies here, and we're going to ask if they can use sparse statistical data to make these distinct causal attributions. So here's the baby, like most of the poor babies in our study. She's confronted with a toy. The toy does not work for her. She can't make it go. And the question is, what does she think is going on? Is she doing something wrong? Is she not pushing hard enough? Or is she not manipulating the button correctly? And if that's the case, we would expect her maybe to ask for help. Or does she think this toy is broken? It's a crummy toy. It doesn't work reliably. And if that's the case, she should go ahead and approach another toy. This is a pretty crude causal cut of the world, although it's been extremely important in cognitive science in many disciplines. So in artificial intelligence, researchers talk about the difference between the agent state and the environmental state. In education research, people talk about the difference in locus of control. Is it me or the world? Did I not study hard enough, or was the test unfair? So this kind of attribution is a very higher order attribution. Once you decide that the problem is with you, you may not know what it is that you're doing wrong. Once you decide the problem's with the world, you may not know, is it a circuit that's loose, a battery that's dying? There are many other subordinate hypotheses here. But this kind of division substantially narrows the hypothesis space and also affects the kind of behavior you should seek. So what we wanted to know here was whether 16-month-old babies could use minimal statistical data to make this distinction and rationally choose to seek help or explore based on what they thought the more probable cause was. Again, both of these attributions are always possible. The question is, which is more probable? So here's what we did. We showed the baby some toys. I'm just going to show you two of the five conditions here, so only two of these toys are relevant. For right now. In each condition, there were two experimenters. And in one condition, the first experimenter pushed the button on the toy, toy activated, tried it again, toy didn't activate. And then the same thing happened to the second experimenter. One time they tried, they succeeded. The other time, they failed. This looks like the toy is behaving probabilistically. Again, maybe a circuit's loose. Something looks like it should be wrong with the toy. We gave the baby that toy. There was another toy that we put just out of reach, and their parent is right over here in all cases. And of course, the baby's never going to be able to activate the toy. And in this condition, we expected the attribution would be something's probably wrong with the toy, and the baby should change the object because the success and failure was independent of the agent here. The second condition was very similar, except now the outcomes are dependent on the agent. Experimenter one always succeeded, experimenter two always failed. This suggests that maybe the activation of the toy is agent dependent. When the baby themselves fails to activate the toy, it raises the probability that maybe the correct attribution is that they're doing something wrong. They're not the sort of person who can activate the toy. And that's, if that's the case, we expected babies in this condition would be more likely to try to change the agent first and go and ask for help. So again, I'm going to show you what this looks like from just a couple kids.
Go! Let me try, okay? 1, 2, 3, go! Let me try one more time, okay? 1, 2, 3, go! Fiona! toys? Do you remember these toys? I'm going to put this one right here, and I'm going to give this one to you. And you can go ahead and play.
And we can compare it with this child right here.
Three, go! Maybe if I try one more time, Zoe. One, two, three, go! That's weird. There we go! Cool. So you know what? We're gonna give you this red toy, all right, right here, and this green toy is for you to play with. Okay?
All right. So again, what you see there is a systematic difference between the conditions. In the condition where it looked like the toy was at fault, the babies were much more likely to first try to change the object. When it looked from the evidence as if an agent was at fault, they were much more likely to first try to change the agent. So what this suggests is that 16-month-old babies are tracking the statistical dependence between agents, objects, and outcomes. They can use minimal data to make these rational attributions about the probable cause of the failed goal-directed actions. And then these distinct explanatory attributions are helping them choose between two different strategies, asking for help or exploring new objects in the world themselves. So far, what I've shown you is that babies are sensitive to the kinds of evidence that help distinguish competing hypotheses. What I'm going to talk about next is babies' ability to generate this kind of disambiguating evidence for themselves. So a few years ago, we ran a study where we just looked at children's sensitivity to whether or not evidence was confounded or not. So if you want to present confounded evidence to a four-year-old, we used a simple jack-in-the-box toy like this. It had two levers. If you pushed them down at the same time, two puppets popped up in the middle. So there was neither spatial or temporal information to tell you which lever is producing which effect. So although it's a very simple toy, there's lots of causal possibilities. This lever could make them both go. This lever could make them both go. Each lever could make one of them go. You don't know. That's the condition in which the children got confounded evidence. You can compare it with a condition where you provide strong inductive evidence that this lever makes this toy go and this lever makes the other toy go simply by isolating the variables. In both cases, we took this toy away and we brought it back out along with a brand new toy. And the question is, what would the children do? Most of the work on exploration across species has focused on organisms' attention to things like novelty and stimulus complexity. Obviously, this is the more novel stimulus. We wanted to know whether children would tend to override this novelty preference just in the case where they got ambiguous evidence. Would they go back and explore this more because there was more causal uncertainty? Were they sensitive to the epistemic as well as the perceptual properties of this event? So again, I will give you some examples to show you what this looks like. This first child's going to get unambiguous, unconfounded evidence.
Down in mud at the same time, okay? I want to say one, two, three, then we'll both bring them up at the same time, okay? Ready? One, two, three, down. Cool. One, two, three, up. Let's do it again, ready? One, two, three, down. One, two, three, up. Cool. Let's do it where we take turns. You go ahead and you go by yourself on your lever first.
Go ahead.
One, two, three, your turn. One, two, three, up. Cool. And now it'll be my turn. Ready? One, two, three, my turn. One, two, three, down. All right. Well, I'm going to put that there. And this right here. You go ahead and play with whatever you want for a minute, okay?
So far we've contributed nothing new to the field. The child makes a beeline to the novel toy. I'm going to show you next what happens when the child gets confounded evidence about the toy. We got lucky in this case. We got identical twins.
I say one, two, three, go. Then we're going to both charge levers down. When I say one, two, three, up, we'll bring them back up. Okay, ready? One, two, three, down. One, two, three, up. Cool, let's do it again. Ready? One, two, three, down. Cool. One, two, three, up. Let's do it one more time. Ready? One, two, three, down. One, two, three, up. All right. I'm just going to put that in this right here. Okay. And I'm going to write something down for a minute. Why don't you go ahead and play with whatever you want?
All right. So we didn't just look at the first reach, we actually walked away. In all these studies, we walked away. And we're looking at the children's overall playtime over 60 seconds. And the basic finding is we ran a series of different control conditions in each case presenting the children with unconfounded evidence. And whenever they got unconfounded evidence, the children show a novelty preference. A significant majority of individual children choose the newer toy. They spend most of their time playing with the new toy, and their first reach is almost overwhelmingly likely to be to the new toy. But that's not the case when they got confounded evidence. At that point, they spent more time playing with the old toy. More individual children showed the preference, and their first reach is about equally likely to be back to the old toy as to the new toy. So this suggests that four-year-olds are sensitive to this relatively subtle property, which is whether or not plausible causal variables are presented in isolation or synchronously. But what we wrote in that paper is, look, as long as the kids are sensitive to ambiguity and they tend to explore it, they're going to be likely to disambiguate variables in the fullness of time. They don't really need to know anything about how to isolate variables. They don't need to be engaging in particularly informative actions. They're just in the fullness of time, the chances that they will do so tend to go up. In this next study, however, we actually asked a harder question of children. We asked whether they would specifically and systematically favor interventions that had the potential for information gain. Do they, in their exploration, when they have uncertainty, tend to choose those interventions that isolate variables? So here's what we did in this study. The children were given some beads. The beads were each differently colored. And in one condition, we placed each bead one at a time on the toy. The toy lit up and played music. And in one condition, every single bead did that. So the base rate information is that all the causes are successful. The other condition was the same, except that only some of the beads worked. Half the beads worked, half the beads didn't. And again, there's no perceptual cues as to which bead will work or which bead won't. And that's all that distinguishes the two conditions. From then on, all the children see the same thing, which is this. We show them two pairs of beads. One pair of beads is glued together. They cannot come apart. We show them that. We say, we can't pull it apart. You try. They try to pull it apart. They can't pull the beads apart. The other condition, these are snappable beads. They can snap them apart, snap them together. We can do that. They can do that. Everybody knows that. Then we take each pair as a pair, and we put it on the toy. And as a pair, both beads activate the toy. In principle, this evidence is confounded in all cases. Either bead in each pair might activate the toy, or both beads might activate the toy. But if your base rate information is that every bead activates the toy, there's not a lot of information to be gained here. You should assume that all of these beads activate the toy. And we expected that when we walked away, kids would play indiscriminately with these pairs of beads. But that's not the case in the some beads condition. In the some beads condition, there's a real mystery. Maybe this bead activates the toy. Maybe this bead does. Maybe they both do. The children don't know. If they're sensitive to the uncertainty And if they understand that only one of these bead pairs has the right affordances to potentially find out, in only one case can you isolate the variables, separate them, and try each bead separately, the kids should selectively play with the separable pair of beads just in this condition, just in the condition where there's information to be gained. So that's what we were coding for, whether children pulled apart the beads and tried each bead individually on the toy. Of course, when they try the first bead, it might not work, which suggests the second bead does, but we thought the kids would be eager to find out. Or it might work, in which case they should also test the second bead. So we ran both conditions, and here are the results. In the all beads condition, exactly one child even snapped apart the separable beads. Basically, they just put the beads as pairs on the toy and listened to the music. But in the some beads condition, about half the kids in each of these conditions did the exhaustive experiment. They pulled the beads apart, they tested each bead one at a time on the toy. So this suggests they're sensitive to uncertainty, and they're also sensitive to how to resolve that uncertainty, to what kinds of interventions are relevant. But we'd given them a hint. We'd put each bead originally, when we were showing them the training conditions, on the toy. So what we wanted to know was whether they could not just select informative interventions, but actually design them. And my graduate student at the time, Claire Cook, said, the kids are doing something kind of interesting even with the stuck beads in the some beads condition. And I said, what can they do with the stuck beads? They're stuck. There's nothing you can do with them. And she said, well, let's just try it again and only give them the stuck pair of beads. So we ran it again, new groups of kids. One group of kids learns that every bead works. Another group of kids learns that only some of the beads work. But this time, both group of kids just see one pair of beads. It's the stuck pair of beads. We place it horizontally on the toy. The toy activates, and then we walk away. And let me show you an example of a child in the some beads condition. So this is the setup. They're going to see the toys work.
Well, can you just watch and see what happens? All right. So take a look at this. Look, this one makes the machine go. Talk about this one. This one doesn't make the machine go. This one doesn't make the machine go. Let's try this one. Look, this one makes the machine go. Kathleen, I have a question for you. I'll call you back in just a minute.
So this was the intervention we were coding for, whether the children would systematically contact vary the beads just in that condition. And again, these are the results. We essentially never saw that behavior in a condition where there was no information to be gained, but in the condition where there was uncertainty, about half the kids performed this exhaustive intervention, trying each bead separately on the toy. So preschoolers are using information about the base rate of candidate causes to distinguish the relative ambiguity of evidence. And given ambiguous evidence, they're both selecting and designing informative interventions that isolate relevant causal variables in accordance with what they believe probable causal hypotheses are. Is this clear? All right. Whoops. Sorry. So far I've talked about children as if they're just out there in the world exploring in isolation. It's a very Piagetian view. But of course, what we know about human beings in particular is that we learn in a richly social context, much like this one right here. And of course, children do as well. They come into the world surrounded by people who are knowledgeable and invested in helping them. And so one of the questions is how children make use of this information, and especially since they can learn from other people and they can explore the world, how do they negotiate between these different routes to learning? So the next couple studies I'm going to talk about are these sorts of rational trade-offs in instruction and exploration. And we came again from a formal standpoint. Again, for each of these studies, you can, for those of you who are familiar with computational models, you can probably generate them or an idea of what they're like relatively easy. These are things we're now able to capture rigorously. It's much more recently that we've been able to talk in rigorous ways about what it might mean to learn from others. And again, it comes back to the idea of making different inferences depending on how evidence is sampled. And if somebody is sampling and they know the hypothesis space, they know, say, the extension of object properties, or they know the number of functions from a toy, the inferences you can make about the evidence they generate in that context are different than the inferences you would make if you think this evidence is being randomly generated. And what this experiment is going to do is just going to look at a simple toy example of that. So if you assume that an adult is helpful and knowledgeable, you can assume that the evidence they show you is not only true, because of course any process is going to generate what's true of the world, but that the evidence they're giving you is special. It's helping to distinguish target hypotheses from other hypotheses. So, for instance, if a knowledgeable teacher shows you, here's my toy, this toy does two things. You should assume it does two things, not three things or 10 things or 12 things, because if it did 3 or 10 or 12, and the teacher's being knowledgeable and helpful, they should have shown you this. In the same way, in normal communicative exchanges, if I say, do you have any sisters? And you say, yes, I have two sisters. I should assume you have two and not 3 or 4 or 5, because if you were being helpful, you should have told me. What this means is that you can make inferences about what is not present in a way that is not true if the same evidence is discovered by a naive learner or are demonstrated by a naive learner or discovered by the child herself. So if I just happen accidentally upon a toy and find two properties, I shouldn't infer that other properties are absent. Or if I'm the child and I'm playing around, I find two properties, there could easily be 3 or 4 or 10. So the kinds of assumptions you make under pedagogical sampling assumptions are different than the kind of inferences you would make under other kinds of sampling assumptions. In particular, pedagogy strengthens the inference that absence of evidence for something is in fact good evidence for its absence. Right. In general, the longer we go without failing to discover something suggests that thing is absent. But under a pedagogical context where the person is assumed to know, that inference is much stronger. And what this predicts, importantly, is a trade-off between instruction and exploration. Because if a knowledgeable teacher demonstrates properties of a toy, children should rationally not engage in additional exploration because they should assume those properties are not there. But if a naive learner demonstrates the same properties, or a teacher who is interrupted in the middle of the demonstration, the children should not make that assumption. They should explore more broadly. So I'm going to show you how this study works. We had a novel toy. It had 4 interesting properties, in fact. It had a squeaker that you could pull out the yellow tube and squeak. It had a light here. It had a mirror. And if you push that yellow tab, it made music. So none of these are obvious properties that the children will discover, but they could discover them in playing. And we always demonstrated only the squeaker if we demonstrated anything at all. And we did so in 1 of 4 conditions. One condition, watch this, I'm going to show you my toy. Wow, see that. This is a pedagogical condition because saying my toy assumes I know something about it. The accidental condition's the same, but we say, look at this neat toy I found here. Wow, see that? And we just pull the tube accidentally. In the no demonstration, the kids are just introduced to the toy at baseline. The interrupted condition is exactly the same as the pedagogical condition. Watch this, I'm going to show you my toy. Wow, see that? Except now, right at the end, we say, excuse me, wait, I have to go make a phone call. And we run away, right? And what that does is it disrupts the implication, the implicature, that this is exhaustive evidence, that you should assume that that was a complete demonstration and therefore other properties are absent. So what we predicted is that the children would constrain their exploration in the pedagogical condition relative to all of the remaining conditions. To show you, again, I'm going to show you a child in the pedagogical condition here.
I'm going to show you my toy. This is my toy. Isn't it cool?
Yeah. And there's the ball in there.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to show you how my toy works, Isaac. Watch this. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Can you let me know when you're done?
Here.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
do it right when I'm done with this. Great. Can I ask you some questions?
Sure thing.
Okay.
I'm very smart for a 5-year-old.
Oh, I bet you are. Okay, Isaac. Can you listen to this? Can you show me how to make that noise? Good job. Okay, Isaac. I have another question. Can you watch this? Do you see that? Do you see it light up?
Yeah.
Can you show me how to make the toy light up?
Unable to show her any of the other properties. So that's what we found overall, that in the pedagogical condition, the children performed many fewer actions relative to the conditions and discovered fewer of the other functions of the toy. So this is, and again, that child is very smart for a 5-year-old. It's a perfectly rational inference. It's a good inference. There is a formal trade-off between the assumptions you should make under those kinds of under-instructed conditions and otherwise. I'm going to show you now an extension of that study. One thing you might be worried about is this a cognitive assumption or is it a sort of politeness or permission instruction? Maybe the child inferred that they were supposed to play with the toy that way, or that they simply should, or it was good manners to plan that way. And we have two pieces of evidence that that's not the case. One I'm about to show you, but the other is unpublished work by some Wellesley undergraduates. They actually ran a condition where they did tell the kids, this is how you're supposed to play with the toy. They weren't overly strict and authoritarian about it, but they gave them a permission instruction as opposed to, this is how my toy works. And it turns out if you explicitly say, this is how you're supposed to play with the toy, the kids ignore you and they explore broadly. So if you have this explicit contrast with the permission condition, they don't pay attention to it. But I think this is even better evidence that that what the children are doing is making a rational cognitive inference about the properties of the toy. So the question we're going to ask here is, when a teacher goes ahead and provides insufficient information, suppose you know that teacher did a bad job. Suppose you know the number of properties out there and you see that the teacher doesn't present all the evidence. Are kids aware of this? Do they recognize these kinds of sins of omission as failures? There's been a lot of work recently showing that children are sensitive to the reliability of evidence. They're sensitive to sins of commission. They're even sensitive to them in probabilistic ways. So if one speaker labels words accurately 70% of the time, and another speaker labels them accurately 30% of the time, and then both teachers point to a novel object and give a novel word, very young children will choose the word of the more accurate speaker over the inaccurate speaker. But that's an explicit sin of commission, right? The person has been frequently telling you, you know, that this object here is a rabbit, right? So they're sensitive to these kinds of violations. What about sins of omission? What if you simply fail to provide information you could have provided? Does this affect children's judgment of teachers? Do they modulate their own behavior, their own exploration, depending on how adequate they think that the evidence was? There's a very important caveat here, which is, of course, that there are many very good reasons for a teacher to provide insufficient information. One good reason is that we know kids are good at inductive generalization. If you show them one blicket activates a toy, they can infer that all blickets activate a toy. You don't need to show them one blicket after another after another. Another reason why you might not want to provide exhaustive information about the world is that this evidence is just too complicated or too extensive for the learner to handle. We don't try to teach calculus to our kindergarteners. We just know that information is going to overwhelm them. So there are good reasons why you might want to provide just a limited sample of evidence. So it's not always a sin of omission. But here we're going to focus on cases where it clearly is. So in most of these contexts, it's obvious that you're dealing in a very complicated domain. And in contexts where evidence supports generalization, kids are good at it exactly because they can recognize these kinds of contexts. What we're going to do here is take a context where the evidence doesn't support generalization. You couldn't draw the inferences just from the sample. And it's not a complicated domain. And we're going to ask whether when teachers fail to provide adequate information here, children recognize that they did something wrong. So here's what the study looked like. children had a toy like this. I'm not sure if you can see the toy very well, but it has lots of different little gadgets hanging out. The children get to play with the toy, and they find that only one of those gadgets does anything, the wind-up mechanism. So when they play with the toy, they learn this toy, it does one thing. Other children play with a toy that looks identical. But in fact, on this toy, all the gadgets work. It has the wind-up mechanism, but it also has lights and a spin globe and music. The children play with this toy, and they learn that this toy does four things. So the children now know about the toys. What happens next is a teacher comes along and teaches Elmo about the toys. Elmo doesn't know anything about these toys. Elmo has never seen these toys before. And in all cases, the teacher is going to teach just a single function, just the wind-up mechanism. And the question is, do the kids think that the teacher did a better job when they taught one function and there was only one than when the teacher taught one function and there were really four? So we're going to ask the children to rate the teachers on a rating scale. And of course, we want to know that they can use the rating scale, so we're going to compare this first, we're going to benchmark them on sins of commission. There's a correct teacher who labels a duck, there's an incorrect teacher who labels a rabbit a cow. They'd better be able to rate the correct teacher higher than the incorrect teacher, or we think they don't understand our rating scale. We did exclude a few children for that. In general, kids were very good at this, and they rated the correct teacher higher than the incorrect teacher. And the question then was, how would they treat a sin of omission? And what you won't be surprised to hear is that the children are quite sensitive to it. Although the teacher's doing the same thing, the teachers think that this teacher did a much worse job on the whole than this teacher did right here, just based on their own knowledge about the toy. So we want the truth, but we also want the whole truth. What we were really interested in this study, however, was whether children's sensitivity to this kind of evidence under these sampling conditions affected children's own exploration, how they learned from teachers. So this is the last study I'm going to show you. What we did was the same thing you saw already. The children got to play with a one-function toy, a four-function toy. They saw a toy teacher, and the toy teacher always taught the wind-up mechanism, in this case, to the student. We compare this with another condition where there's, again, a four-function toy, but this time the teacher is going to be a good teacher and teach all four of these functions. But in this case, after the kids have explored, they've learned the functions of the toy, they've seen the teacher teach either one function, or all four functions, depending on the condition, we don't have the children rate the teacher. Instead, the teacher brings out that other toy from the previous study and says, "Watch this, this is how my toy works," and pulls the squeaker. Again, that toy has a lot of other properties. We're going to let the kids explore, and what we want to know is how the kids explore this toy based on their judgments of the teacher from the previous toy. So let me spell out the predictions. In the teach one of one condition, they had a good, reliable teacher teach one toy. When the teacher teaches the squeaker on the new toy, we think the kids will believe the teacher and show constrained exploration, just as in our previous study. In the teach one of four condition, however, we predicted a different outcome. We thought in this case the teacher had committed a sin of omission previously. If the kids modulate their exploration based on that sin of commission, then in this case, when the teacher shows them this toy, this is what my toy does, and shows them the squeaker, then they should not trust the teacher, and they should show broader exploration if they're accommodating to the teacher's reliability. But of course, we don't know if they're actually looking at the teacher here, if they're looking at the toy. They might generalize from a one-function toy and say, well, that toy did one thing, this toy probably does. This toy did four things, that toy probably does four things. So we compared it with this condition here, where the toy does four things, the teacher teaches four things. If they're just generalizing from the toy, and they say, well, that toy did four things, this toy should do four things, then when the teacher shows the squeaker, well, they should say, well, this toy did four things, maybe this one does too, and they should explore broadly. But if what they're sensitive to is to the ways in which evidence is generated, then here the teacher was reliable, said toy does four things, showed them everything. In this case, the teacher just shows the squeaker. The children should trust the teacher and show constrained exploration down here. And that's what you're going to see. So what the children's own exploration was sensitive to the kind of instruction they had received previously, and they're adjusting their own exploration. So if they think that the teacher is likely to have omitted information, the children themselves explore more. So children recognize these sins of omission. They modulate their learning. And what you actually see is the children nicely titrating between two pillars of developmental psychology. Lev Vygotsky, who talked about children's social learning, and of course Piaget's learning from exploration. And they're again balancing off these strategies based on what we think are formally rational inferences about the evidence that they're getting. Okay, so what I've shown you is a small sample today, I think, of the ways in which we think children's inferential processes are enormously rich and sophisticated. Again, I think we have very good evidence across a host of these abilities that children are drawing very, very rich inferences from patterns of evidence, and it's guiding their own learning. It's guiding the way that they generate evidence for themselves. It's guiding what they believe about the evidence generated by others. I'm going to end, as I began, however, by saying that ultimately it's not going to be satisfying to show evidence for each of these, or even to show that we can formally characterize each of these rational inferences individually. What we would ultimately like is a grand unifying theory, a computational model that generated all and only those processes that supported inquiry and discovery, something that explained how it is that we can get the world right across all of these range of abilities. So I'm going to end with a quote by Mark Twain. He said he had something astute to say about every aspect of human experience, so I think it's not surprising that he summed up what I take to be the central problem of cognitive science with this witticism. He said, "There's something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment in fact." And he meant this as a joke, of course, but it's true. From a few bones, we infer the existence of dinosaurs. From fruit flies, the mechanisms of heredity. From spectral lines, the composition of nebulae. And perhaps most alarmingly of all, from some massively reconstructed images of blood flowing through the brain, or worse still, the behavior of preschool children, we tried to say something about the fundamental mechanisms of human cognition. But I think actually this is the process by which cognition works. Thank you very much, and I want to thank my co-authors and funders and collaborators. And I'd be happy to take questions.